Welcome to the Jaws of Justice. My name is Keith Brown Eel. Today, Peter Hoffman talks with Jim Lafferty, Executive Director of the Los Angeles Chapter of the National Lawyers Guild, about his years of service to progressive causes and organizations for almost 50 years. Jim will be here in Kansas City to speak later this week. Stay right here to find out more. Then later, the ACLU Minute and our calendar of events. And now, here's Peter with Jim.
Hello, my name is Peter Hoffman. Thank you for tuning in to the Jaws of Justice radio program on KKFI 90.1 FM, Kansas City Community Radio. Today's guest is here to talk about the role attorneys have played throughout history in helping to protect the rights of protesters and others involved in social justice movements. Jim Lafferty has been a movement lawyer, political organizer, and legal worker for the past 50 years. He has served as a chief officer of and spokesperson for various national anti-war coalitions. He established numerous draft counseling centers in the Midwest and helped organize some of the largest Vietnam War protests. In the 60s and 70s, his law firm represented virtually all of the left political movements in and around Detroit. In the early 1980s, Mr. Lafferty founded and chaired the largest ACLU chapter in the state of Michigan. For the last two decades, Jim has served as the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild of Los Angeles, most recently heading that chapter's well-publicized support for Occupy LA. Jim Lafferty, thank you for joining us.
Good to be with you, Peter. Good to be with you.
I must say, that's quite the resume. Can you talk personally about what brought you on your journey to do the type of work that you do?
Well, I'm often asked that question. Suppose what really turned me in that direction perhaps was my own situation as a young boy. I grew up in a very, very poor section of Detroit, in the inner city of Detroit. There was, of course, a fair amount of racism and anti-Semitism and of course, a great deal of poverty. And yet, when I would go to the local public school, which was a pretty good public school, it was obvious to me that everybody was not quite in that same situation, given the way our school district happened to fall. And I suppose early on, therefore, I came to appreciate that everybody is not born equal in terms of opportunity. Some people are born with more backing, a stronger social network, more money in the bank, and so forth. And it allowed me to understand, I think, at an early age, some of the injustices that flow from living in a society where some can have so much and some can have so little.
Early on, were you drawn to any particular issues, or what was it that set you on your path to become an attorney?
I graduated high school in 1956, and the early 50s were not a time of a great deal of political activism in this country. You had the Korean War come up during that period of time, but I was a little young to be concerned with that. And then from 1956 to 1960, I was a student at the University of Michigan, where I certainly did engage in some of the activities that were going on, some of the protest activities that were going on, mainly having to do with issues of fairness and equity on campus itself, as opposed to in the broader community of Ann Arbor, where University of Michigan is situated. By the time I was in law school, of course, that was changing. I was older, a bit more sophisticated. I met in law school a number of wonderful faculty members who were doing progressive lawyering outside of their teaching duties. And as luck would have it, one of my dearest friends at the time was a white nurse who divorced her white school teacher husband and married a black doctor. She had a three-year-old little girl. And her ex-husband and her own mother took her to court to take custody away from her and give it to the white father under the theory that a biracial home was not a good home in which to raise a child. And this, as I say, was in 1962. In fact, that story later went on to become a movie called One Potato, Two Potato. And in the course of that, I met some of the founding members of the National Lawyers Guild, one of whom, George Crockett Jr., a longtime civil rights lawyer, a lawyer who himself had gone to jail during the McCarthy days because of his vigorous defense of so-called communists in front of who were being tried under the Smith Act. I brought this case of my friend to him. He hired me as his law clerk, and that case was lost, by the way, and it was lost in Detroit, Michigan in the 60s, went all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and my friend still lost. The court still found, despite the fact that this was a totally fit mother, totally fit father, a totally fit stepfather, perfectly fine home environment. It was the fact of a biracial marriage that cost her the custody of her daughter in the 60s and not in the South, but in Detroit, Michigan. And, of course, that was quite an eye-opener for me. And as a result of my exposure to the Goodman Crockett Law Firm, which was one of the founding law firms of the National Lawyers Guild in 1937, I ended up being hired as the national director of the National Lawyers Guild when I graduated law school in 1963 and served in that position until 1966 and 67.
Through that guild work that you did, can you just talk about some of the guild work you did? What organizations and social movements did you partner with? What kind of types of support were you giving as attorneys to these movements?
As soon as I got out of law school, they passed a law, or really a court rule in Michigan, that allowed a law student under the supervision of a practicing attorney to do free legal work for poor people. And this was really before there was a bunch of legal service programs in the country. I set one of those up in Detroit. We had a lot of law students, got some good practice representing people on minor misdemeanors and what have you in the courts of Detroit under the supervision of a lawyer. Later, of course, at this period of time, though, the Vietnam War is coming around. By the time you get to 1965, 1966, one of the first really big Anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, of course, were in 1967. By that time, I was already the head of the anti-war movement in Detroit. We organized a coalition called the Detroit Coalition to End the War in Vietnam Now. That was also part of a national coalition called the Mobilization Against the War. And that's when my work in organizing protests in the streets, in this case around the war, took off in earnest, and we did organize both locally and then nationally many large anti-war demonstrations. During that same time, of course, the draft was a key issue, and in Detroit, I opened up what was the first multi-purpose draft counseling center in the country. Up until that time, you could go to various Quaker groups and the Center for Committee for Conscientious Objectors. And if you were a conscientious objector, you could get their help in staying out of the war. But if you objected for political reasons or health reasons or poverty reasons, there was nobody to help you. And so we set up draft counseling centers in Detroit and all around the Midwest. And then some years later, when I formed a law firm of about seven of us, three or four of us specialized in draft law and in military law, helping those who were trying to avoid service in Vietnam, particularly a lot of the political activists who were wanting to stay out of the war in order to organize the movement against it. So that was some of the early protest work around Vietnam. And as a consequence of that, some years later, when the war was still raging, I, along with some others, organized the National Peace Action Coalition, which then held on April 24th, 1971, the largest anti-war protest in the history of the country. Between San Francisco and Washington, D.C., there were over a million people in the streets that day. As a consequence of that, I suppose, then being in the national leadership of the anti-war movement, the government of North Vietnam invited myself and about five or six others of us who were playing that role in the country's anti-war movement to come and visit in North Vietnam. It was illegal to do so at the time, but we went anyway. We had an opportunity to meet the people of Vietnam, pretty much wander around anywhere we wished. And, of course, we met all of the various governmental officials in Vietnam. I was able to see some of the bomb damage that was being done, even as I was there, to the Bac Bai Hospital, which is a famous hospital in Hanoi. I learned a lot of important lessons there. And I suppose the most important was taught to me, in a sense, by Premier Phan Van Dong, then Premier of North Vietnam. We had an audience with him one evening, the six of us and him, and I asked him why wherever I wandered in Hanoi, despite the fact that I was an American and my country was dropping bombs as I was wandering about on their country, his countrymen seemed so welcoming and friendly to me. Essentially, we make it our business to educate our people that the United States, people of the United States, are not our enemy. And that, in fact, many of them, such as yourselves, are organizing to get your government to stop waging war on us. I thought that was very profound. At that same meeting, one of the persons with me had been a U.S. bomber pilot. He had dropped bombs on Vietnam during the war. And as Phan Van Dong was talking, he began to cry, saying he was so ashamed that He had never been to the country before on the ground, but he'd flown over it. He'd dropped bombs on it, and he was so ashamed. And Van Van Dock jumped up, threw his arms around him, began to cry himself, and said, "It doesn't matter. You come back as a friend." And I think the lesson from that for all of us is that we ought not to let the government or really anybody else decide who our friends and who our enemies really are. Today, it's not the people of Iraq that are our enemies. It's not the people of the land that are our enemies. It's not the people of Afghanistan or Pakistan and so forth. And we ought not to let those people be demonized because the folks who rule this country decide they can get a better deal if they put a different dictator or a different ruler in some foreign country. And in the meanwhile, somehow the American people are supposed to go to war against that country or hate the people of that country. So that was a very important lesson and one that has stayed with me all of these days.
I want to remind our listeners that they're listening to Jaws of Justice Radio on KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Our guest today is Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild of Los Angeles, Jim Lafferty. We feature a lot of organizations on this program and in other programs that advocate and provide services. What sort of tips or advice can you give to organizers and advocates, and how can we steer the American narrative towards social justice ends?
Well, that's a great question. It encompasses several aspects. One of the things that I stress all the time in the National Lawyers Guild, the Lawyers Guild is the legal arm of the progressive movement in this country in many respects. In Los Angeles, certainly, and in any major city in the country, you really can't name a socially progressive, politically progressive group fighting for against wars or for immigrants' rights or for end of police abuse or for freedom of speech. Whatever it is, the Lawyers Guild is going to be helping to defend those groups. We sometimes say the Constitution is our only client, but it's those community groups you're talking about. And one of the things, the fact, we often brag about the fact that J. Edgar Hoover once said that the Lawyers Guild was as dangerous as bomb throwers because, of course, we were fighting his efforts to demonize and criminalize anybody who would protest policies of the U.S. government. But one of the things I often tell our law students in the Lawyers Guild now is, and young lawyers in general, you know, is look, the movements that we serve, whether it's the immigrant rights movement or the Occupy movement or whatever it might be, these movements generally know more about what they need and how to get there than we do. Oh, they don't know as much about the law as we do, but we can't substitute ourselves for them. We can't think we're smarter than they are when it comes to what they should be demanding and how they go about demanding it. Our job is to simply try to keep them out of the courts because, frankly, and defend them in the courts when we have to, because, frankly, if you look at social progress in this country over the years, there has been far more social progress won on the streets of America than in the courts or the legislatures of America. Oh, it's true, a Civil Rights Act is finally passed, but it's only passed after tens of thousands of people sit in at lunch counters and fight against their denial of the right to vote and get dogs stuck on them and all the rest of it. Yes, the Vietnam War finally ended because Congress stopped passing the money for it. But that only happened after years when we built such a massive movement on the streets of this country against the war that no president and no Congress, be they Democrat or Republican, could continue the war. That mass movement had made it too unpopular, too untenable. And in fact, remember the war in Vietnam ended under Presidents Nixon and Ford, hardly men of peace. Same thing was true of the abortion rights movement. It wasn't those nine men who finally decided Roe versus Wade didn't simply wake up one morning and say, "Jesus, we've been wrong all these years. Of course women have a right to choose." No, hundreds of thousands of women and their supporters had been marching in the streets for years and going to jail and what have you to demand that right so that the court had really no choice but to find these people right. So that's something I try to explain to our young lawyers. Give the legal service and then get out of the way. Your job is not to try to win the revolution in the courtroom, but to make sure that your clients who know what they need and your community groups that you're recognizing know what they need and how to get it, have a chance to do it free of undue interference from the government. Of course, how one builds those coalitions and formulates the strategy of those coalitions, that's another matter.
You mentioned your work with Occupy Los Angeles. Can you go back, and I understand you were actually arrested recently. Can you talk about your involvement with Occupy and your relationship, and particularly that incident?
Yeah. I got arrested along with my wife in New York, which I'll talk about in a moment. What happened in L.A. was instructive, I think, in terms of how progressive lawyers, people's lawyers, as we call them, should work with groups. I got a call one day from someone who had come in from New York announcing they were going to start an occupation in L.A. Would I help? I said yes. I was, because we've had good relations with the police in L.A., we've sued them enough and won enough so that we can now talk to them. I called up the chief of police, explained the situation, and we quickly came to an agreement that they'd be able to set up their encampment on the lawn of City Hall, and there they remained for a couple of months. A little bit longer, in fact, than the occupation in New York was able to survive at Zuccotti Park. Eventually, of course, after first being welcomed by the mayor and welcomed by the city council, the politicians, the big money interest in town who elect the city council and the mayor, got upset about what the occupied movement was doing, which was, of course, protesting the economic injustice perpetrated by the banks and the mortgage companies that were giving all the money to the politicians. And so they were finally forced off that lawn. But all along, during the two-month occupation, I and other members of the guild would be there every day, basically. Some of our younger guild members slept the nights there in the tents. We would be giving advice to the occupiers as to what their rights were to be there and how to exercise those rights in the most intelligent way. When they held their off-site protests and demonstrations, we went with them to make sure that they were not interfered with unduly by the police. Near the end, there were some negotiations that took place between the occupiers and the city as to how that occupation would end and what might be done for the occupation movement. They asked me to be part of that and so forth. So we were an advisor to that movement, and by demonstrating our commitment to it ourselves, by walking the walk with these people, if you will, then they trust you more. And by understanding that it was their movement to design and their movement to lead, and simply we were there for consultation and legal advice and legal defense, and when they were all arrested, of course, we represented them and defended them, and have gotten most of those people off from any criminal charges. That's the kind of partnership I think it's proper to have between a people's lawyer and any social justice movement. What happened in New York very quickly, New York police were very different. They were very brutal. They arrested people needlessly all the time. That happened to my wife and I. The details really aren't important. The charges were ultimately dropped, as they were against many people who were arrested. Of course, we were charged with resisting arrest and all sorts of things. That's what the police always do when they rough you up and then and arrest you wrongfully and so forth. And indeed, many, many people are suing, including the 700 people who were arrested wrongfully on the Brooklyn Bridge. And New York will continue to, the taxpayers in New York will continue to pay the price for that.
That actually brings up the effectiveness of these lawsuits against the police departments. I know the one that comes to my mind most recently was at UC Davis, the now kind of infamous pepper spray incident where the students were maced by the police. Can you talk about what kind of legal processes are available to hold the police accountable for their misconduct?
Yeah. We have a very active police accountability bar in Los Angeles as well. And throughout the country, in the major cities, there are such folks. Indeed, the largest police settlement in the country so far historically was won by some National Lawyers Guild lawyers in Los Angeles a few years ago when the police rioted and beat up and arrested hundreds of people at MacArthur Park in Los Angeles on May 1st at the big immigrant rights march. The city ended up paying close to $13 million on that one and had to apologize to everybody. From time to time, when the police act as brazenly wrong and as brazenly unconstitutional as they did at UC Davis, where without the necessity of need to do so whatsoever, a police officer simply sprays pepper spray directly into the eyes and the faces of peaceful protesters, as opposed to simply arresting them, if that's what was called for even, they end up paying the price. Every year in Los Angeles, we and other lawyers here win monetary damages against the police. It's true all over the country because they either beat somebody up or arrest somebody they're not supposed to arrest or interfere with a political demonstration that was lawful and peaceful that shouldn't have been interfered with. And happily, there's still the opportunity to do that in the courts. I must say it's gotten tougher. The Supreme Court has gotten more conservative. The government itself and the mood in the country post 9/11 is more conservative, and so winning some of those cases is not as easy. Perhaps it never was easy, but even more difficult than ever. But every day we win them, and every day the people who are engaging in those protests therefore feel they feel safer to come back to the streets because they know there are lawyers who are looking out for them. We're wearing, in the case of the Lawyers Guild, you know, our green legal observer caps and so forth. And if you do it right, as we do here in Los Angeles, you can actually develop a decent working relationship with the police that minimizes the need to sue them afterwards. So And that's what we're looking for. We're not looking for lawsuits. We're looking for the police to honor the rights of peaceful and legal protesters.
Your background, you've been doing this for quite some time now, and obviously the way attorneys engage with movements in the past might be different than it is today, and indeed social movements are different today than they were in the past. What do you envision the role of legal advocates to be in the social movements in this day and age of non-hierarchical movements and going forward?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's more difficult for lawyers who, after all, do have a couple of college degrees and what have you, and even if we try not to be snobby about it, I think we're not used to, especially the older lawyers, are not used to the new non-hierarchical kinds of movements like the Occupy movement. But we can learn, just like everybody else. We learned in Los Angeles and New York and in Oakland and San Francisco and Chicago and all over the country. Our young lawyers don't need that training. They come out of law school. Many of them have been the product of some of those same movements before they were in law school. So I think the future looks very bright for the cooperation between new social justice economic rights movements of today and the progressive lawyers of today and tomorrow. I think the generational gap there is closed, effectively, if you will, because so many of the lawyers that now do this work are of a generation where they easily understand and adapt and can work more smoothly, I think, with some of the new forms of social and political organizing.
Well, Jim, thank you for joining us. We're about out of time. I do want to let our listeners know that Mr. Jim Lafferty is coming to Kansas City Thursday, October the 18th, for two speaking engagements. He'll be at the University of Missouri Kansas City School of Law at 11:30 a.m. in the Student Lounge. We'll also be addressing the local chapter of the National Lawyers Guild at the Simpson House at 6 p.m. that same evening. Both events are free and open to the public. More information can be found on www.nlgkansascity.org. Jim, thank you so much for joining us today.
Peter, thank you. No, thank you, my friend.
As always, I'd like to thank our listeners for tuning in to the Jaws of Justice Radio on Kansas City Community Radio, KKFI 90.1 FM. For more information, visit our website at www.kkfi.org. Thank you and have a great day.
There is now a fourth branch of the United States government.
I'm Tom Harbin, and this is the Civil Liberties Minute with ACLU attorney Bill Newman.
The fourth branch is called Top Secret America. As reported by the Washington Post, based on a two-year investigation, Top Secret America consists of approximately 1,300 government agencies contracting with about 2,000 private companies, employing altogether, give or take, a million people with a yearly budget of more than $75 billion. Those 1 million people are all dedicated to spying. The result of all this spying? Too much information to analyze by inexperienced analysts who only speak English. So we end up with a Nigerian national boarding a plane from Amsterdam to Detroit because the information about him was bollocksed up in the system, and an army major not being stopped from opening fire at Fort Hood, Texas, even though some intelligence agencies already had him in their sights. We've heard a lot recently about Russian spies living in our suburbs. It seems that American spies in Colorado, Texas, Florida, Nebraska, and states and cities and towns and suburbs across America, through the ineptness of the government, at great expense and with little or no oversight, are putting us all at way more risk.
The Civil Liberties Minute is made possible by the ACLU. Support the ACLU at ACLU.org because democracy and advocacy begin with you and freedom can't defend itself.
This is the Jaws of Justice radio calendar of events. My name is Keith Brown Eel. The Fall Harvest Fundraiser for the National Lawyers Guild of Kansas City will be held this Thursday, October 18th from 6 to 8:30 p.m. This will be at the Simpson House, 4509 Walnut, Kansas City, Missouri. This year's special guest is Jim Lafferty, recipient of the National Lawyers Guild Law for the People Award. Jim has been a movement lawyer, organizer, and legal worker for the past 50 years. You are invited to come and hear him recount his history from the Vietnam War protests to Occupy LA. For more information, go to their website, www.nlgkansascity.org, or send an email to mail@nlgkansascity.org. The Federation of Midwest Korean Americans Association, USA, and artists, Helping the Homeless cordially invites you to participate in this event. This will be from 350 new, there will, pardon me, this will provide 350 new winter coats to Kansas City homeless at the Country Club Christian Church, 6101 Ward Parkway, 6:30 p.m. On Thursday, October 25th, there will be a short ceremony with Mayor Sly James before the distribution. For more information, you can call Carl Wu at 313-523-1826. The Joint Interim Committee on the Missouri Criminal Code will have their second hearing to receive public comments tomorrow, Thursday, October 16th at 1 p.m. The second hearing to receive public comments tomorrow, Tuesday, October 16th at 1 p.m. The hearing will be held at the Senate Lounge at State Capitol in Jefferson City. The topics open for comments and sentencing, sex offenders, registration, and other issues relevant to prosecutors, defense attorneys, courts, crime victims, and law enforcement agencies. To get on the agenda, contact Senator Jolie Justice's office at 573-751-2788. Or just show up. For these items and more, check out the Jaws of Justice Facebook page at www.facebook.com/Jaws of Justice Radio.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the host and guest of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project, Incorporated, its staff or volunteers. If you have comments or questions, check out the Jaws of Justice Radio page on the KKFI website. That's kkfi.org. You can join the Jaws of Justice Radio group by emailing us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com. My name is Jeff Humfeld, and we thank our engineer, Mike Murphy. Listen in tomorrow at 9 a.m. for Law and Disorder. Ray Abelia on the Code Pink anti-drone delegation to Pakistan, and Phyllis Bennis on 11 years of war in Afghanistan. Then, at 6 p.m. Tuesday, tune in for Tell Somebody with Tom Clammer. Up next is Counterspin, followed at 10 o'clock by Beautician's Blues with Luscious Lynn, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for Jazz and Blues in the afternoon and Eco Radio KC at 6 p.m.